Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking to author and artist Amanda Hebert Hughes. Amanda has created her own genre of art. It's called neurodivergent art, and it's catered to people with autism, but everyone will be able to relate to it. Amanda herself is autistic. I learn a little more about exactly what autism is and even recognize some of the traits in myself. It's a fascinating interview. We talk about art, autism, learning, marketing. I learned a lot. I think you will too. Enjoy. I've never been smart with investments or stocks, but one thing I've learned over the years is that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. If you want to get smart with your money, you can trade smarter and maximize your returns with Trade with UFOs. Trade with UFOs is a brand that represents a community of users trading with predictive tools. You don't have to be good with stocks. They literally hold your hand while you trade, teaching you everything you need to know. You see, Trade with UFOs is also a portal which provides access to predictive apps, courses, and coaching, all to show you how to make money using unfilled orders. Why am I so passionate about this? Because then we'll all have more money in our pockets to buy more art. It's time to get smart with your money. Leverage your success with Trade with UFOs. Go to tradewithufos.com and use my offer code Brooke for a 50% off discount on all of their products. That's B-R-O-O-K-E.
How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Oh, I am so excited. I've been reading about this, reading about you, and so much of this resonates with me.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'm so excited. So first of all, you are an author, an artist, an author, and an advocate tell me about how you got into, it's a lot of stuff and a lot of sensory gating. I'm having trouble with that. so how did you get involved, interested in all this? How did you in the whole learning styles and learning processing and stuff like that?
Yeah, sure. So I was actually speaking with a mentor recently, and he said, all the best artists paint because they're compelled to paint and they don't know why they do what they do. They're just compelled to do it. And then you work backwards and kind of find out why you're doing what you're doing. That's exactly what happened for me. I was just compelled to paint a specific way.
Okay.
And when I started, I couldn't explain to anybody why it had to be this way.
Right.
But this is the way I wanted it. This is the way I was going to communicate. This is how I wanted to filter the world around me. Mm-hmm. And then that was before I was diagnosed as autistic. Okay. So when you have a piece of information like that come in after all of this painting has done, then I was able to kind of start to unpack why I do the way I do it and all that kind of thing.
Right.
So that was kind of one of the things. I started out painting and didn't know I was autistic. There was no advocate yet because I didn't know I was autistic. I didn't know that I was going to be a voice for autistic people as an autistic person. So the advocate came later when I found out I was autistic.
Okay.
The genre, I discovered this is a new genre. What I'm doing, it just stands alone.
Right.
The reason why I'm doing it stands alone.
Sorry. How old were you when you found out you were autistic?
I was 34.
Okay.
And now I'm 39.
Okay. So you lived a large part of your life not knowing you were autistic.
Yes. I was a late diagnosed autistic. Yes.
Wow. Did so what were some of the struggles you had growing up, that you just thought were like, what's wrong with me? Kind of stuff that you didn't have any answers
to. Yeah. I think the best way to describe the differences that I look back and can see now. Everything from what they call the double empathy problem. It was discovered in 2012, basically kind of observes that neurodivergent people don't communicate as well with neurotypicals, there's a breakdown of communication that happens. Mm-hmm. Lots of misunderstandings can happen, but neurotypical people can communicate amongst themselves much better. Mm-hmm. It's not that neurodivergent people cannot communicate well. It's just across the neurotypes. Neurodivergent people communicate very well with neurodivergent people. Mm-hmm. So as I'm growing up as an undiagnosed autistic person surrounded by predominantly neurotypical people, there was a lot of misunderstandings, right, and a lot of unfilteredness on my part,
right,
that to me made perfect sense and was, you know, a bridge to make relationships when it was the exact opposite.
Right.
And the exact opposite by people. So I did not have a lot of successful relationships among my peers growing up. I had friendships with people who were much older than me, uh-huh, and people who were much younger than me. I was a babysitter. I was a nanny. The kids I babysat came to my birthdays. I had birthday parties.
Oh, wow. Where,
by the kids that I babysat for and their parents. And it was like, I don't know why anyone was like, oh, that wasn't like, oh, this is very unusual. But that peer-to-peer communication can be very challenging for a lot of autistic people. So okay, looking back, mm-hmm, I see so much, and that's just one of many things that I see. And it was a challenge, you know, because being misunderstood all the time, that's lonely, you know, yeah, and you don't know where the breakdown is.
For sure. For sure. When did you discover you were an artist? When did you start doing art?
I started doing art in early 2019.
Okay, so that's recent.
Yes. Yep. And I got my first autism diagnosis in 2019 as well. So it was, I was already a full-time artist at the beginning of 2019. I found out I was autistic near the end of 2019.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
So you found you were an artist, you became an artist first, and then you could, okay.
Yes. Yes.
That's cool. That's neat. Do you think the two had any correlation, even though you weren't aware of?
Yeah, I can certainly see that now, because when I learned about the cognitive process of sensory gating, mm-hmm, I learned that that's what I was using my art to do. I was filtering out the visual noise around me, uh-huh, and putting it into a nice, clean, filtered, basic information kind of image. And that was so soft to my brain and my mind. And I just thought it was just such a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And so when I learned about actual sensory gate, I'm like, I'm using my art to sensory gate the world around me.
Right.
And a lot of other neurodivergent adults have really been drawn to it as well.
Yeah.
For those reasons. And so every brain does, whether you're neurotypical, it's a cognitive process, but neurotypical minds tend to do it subconsciously more so. So right, it uses less mental energy for them to do it. Whereas neurodivergent people, many of us who are susceptible to sensory overload, it's because we're processing a lot of sensory information consciously. Mm-hmm. So it takes more of our attention, more of our energy, and that kind of thing. So that's why sensory gated art is something that, you know, it's for everybody, because everybody does the sensory gating process.
Right.
But a lot of neurodivergent people or people who are susceptible to sensory overload find, like, they're able to recognize, like, hey, I like that. That's doing something for me.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah, I can totally relate to the sensory overload type thing. And I like the, and I've, and I love the art. I love your art. It's very abstract and expressionist, and I love that. How is it different from abstract expressionists? Are there like conscious choices for colors, or like how would it be different than abstract expressionists?
Yeah, so I have very rigid rules that I apply to the way I create these paintings. So okay. unless I'm painting a living thing or a living being, the lines are always straight or they're always consistent curves.
Okay.
That predictability, that pattern is more structured and comforting for me. So we got those types of lines that we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, the color has to be a relationship. It's information that's easier for the brain to integrate because it senses the color overlap.
Okay.
So to me, that's sensory gating because it's easier information for them to integrate. Okay. So the color palette, the predictable shapes of the lines, and then finally the texture. Okay. The texture, I still have a hard time putting it where it's like the best component. I think it's like the finishing touch to every piece I do. I choose a section that I want to emphasize, and that's where I put texture. And all the colors are solid. There's no blending. There's no transitioning. All the colors are in their clues, because it's more organized. It's easier for my brain to process.
Right, right. Oh, I think that's awesome. I think that's fabulous. And you were talking some about like, it sounds like a lot of it's like interior decorating. What'd you say? Like a neuro-friendly designed room. How do you go about that? Like designing a neuro-friendly room.
I'm so grateful that you asked about that because that's kind of one of my new babies this year was my methods, my theory, the way I kind of methodically think through these experiences of paintings ended up opening into interior design because I kind of stumbled across the fact that I was able to transfer the principles to not just, you know, one two-dimensional image. I was going to apply it to a three-dimensional space. And what had started that was, I'll try to keep it sensory gated. I love that you used that as a verb already. I was like, oh my goodness, she's brilliant. Okay.
That's so true with me. I was like, oh my God, this is me.
I love that. So this year, one of my goals was to create a cult painting collection of where I was going to turn plants into created art. Mm-hmm. I follow neuroscientists and environmental scientists and I read their work. And so one of the physiologists that I follow, her name is Sophie Schuler. Mm-hmm. She's in Europe. She works for Cushman & Wakefield. Her research, and she's very passionate about the fact that we have to have plants in our built environments because the data basically shows that having vegetation, having nature in our environments is good for everybody. Like that's kind of like, well, that makes a lot of sense. So I thought to myself, well, the feedback I get is that sensory gated art reduces anxiety. It does for me. And a lot of people say it reduces anxiety for me as well. And then I'm being told by researchers that plants combat depression. And I thought to myself, wouldn't that be interesting to see a painting that maybe could combat anxiety and depression? I want to see what that would look like.
Right.
So one of the paintings I did for that collection, I designed for my living room. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to do this piece. It's called Fir Trees in the Mist. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty large piece. And so I decided what wall it was going to go on. And then I thought to myself, that's not going to integrate very well with the rest of the room. Uh-huh. So what did I do? I redid the whole room. I changed the colors. I had a very specific strategy. And by the end of that, I had designed a whole design philosophy.
Oh, wow.
That could be reproduced. And I gave it away for free. It's on my website.
Cool.
You can totally, I mean, I've got so much to do. I don't really mind giving it away for free.
Right, right.
But a lot of the principles really make sense, because what it came down to that I was observing is that there's two different types of brains, it seems like people tend to have, all right? There seems to be people who have calmer brains, you know, they tend to be more relaxed by people by nature. They are susceptible to being understimulated, and even depression sometimes. Then you've got other people who have naturally energetic brains. They are prone to sensory overload because they're super high speed and they're prone to anxiety. And I thought to myself, okay, well, I know what design components, colors, and balance is going to tone me down, because I'm processing all these things consciously. And I know what things energize me and overload me. And I thought to myself, well, we got two different kinds of brains in the same space. Sounds like all we need is a balance. So I've got the dark colors that help calm me down, because I have a naturally high energy brain. Also have lighter colors to help combat brains that are just susceptible to being understimulated. And you can even see it when you go to the doctor's office, right? The doctors are either giving uppers for people who are depressed and downers for people who are anxious. So you've got these two different directions. And I thought to myself, this makes a lot of sense. So I published that design theory on my website. And since then, I've been able to do some interior design consulting for a tech company in Chicago, which I've really, really enjoyed. And so I've been branching out into offering design consulting as well.
I love that. Now, this is a question, and I don't mean it the way it might come around, might sound, but like, who would want that? I mean, like, who would recognize that they needed something like that and actually seek out? I mean, I think it's amazing, and I think it's definitely necessary. But like, who is going to realize that they need that and come to you?
Well, most people who are prone to sensory overload and have really active brains, by seeing my art, they tend to recognize the properties, are accomplishing some kind of process for them. But like I said earlier, every brain does the sensory gating process. So it's not necessarily just for those who are prone to sensory overload, because I do have some pieces that have a lot of lines in them. And so there is a balance of stimulation and calming in them.
I guess my question was basically like, how are you marketing that? I mean, how are you reaching the people who need to have it?
Gotcha. Well, I'm on social media platforms. I've had a couple of interviews done and been in some publications, and I have some collectors of my art across the country and the world, and just trying to keep meeting new people and seeing who I can support and help. And I say brick by brick. Every day you may not feel like you accomplish a lot, but it's a brick in the road and you're moving forward.
Yeah, I guess the thing is like, I'm trying to wrap my mind around it, because I have similar things, not at all like that, but I mean, but things that are hard to define and hard to market and find a market or reach it, and tell people that they need it and or have them recognize that they need it. And I was just curious how you were kind of going about that, and I guess since you've got a built-in community, that helps a lot.
It does. I really have to give so much credit to the people that do discover my work and really connect with it. They're all just really amazing at just trying to spread the word and the message. But part of me has accepted that this is a new genre, and it might just take a long time, you know. And whatever's meant to be will be. But I'm still gonna, you know, give it everything I've got and just keep doing it.
For sure. Oh, I think that's awesome. I love process, and I love just finding out stories and how people work. So that's where the question came from. So.
Gotcha. Well, I hope it was enough of an answer.
Yeah, totally. Now, just to kind of clarify, what would you say is sensory overload stimuli?
Okay. So the sensory gating process is the brain's ability to take in information through the five senses and filter out what's important mm-hmm. and what's not important.
Okay.
So those who are susceptible to sensory overload tend to spend more time and energy considering all of the information and all of the possibilities based mm-hmm. on all the pieces of information.
Okay.
So you get to a point where you're spending all of this energy mm-hmm. processing through all these little tiny pieces of information, a brush stroke, a texture, shading, and that's just the visual senses. You know, you're talking about all five senses. You can imagine how much information we're taking in at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
So those who are susceptible to sensory overload are those who don't ignore, or they're not able to ignore the majority of the information coming in at them and okay. kind of just pinpoint their focus on this is relevant instead right. and ignore what's irrelevant.
Yeah.
And that can happen. I mean, neurodivergent people are very familiar with that. It can also happen to anybody if they're going through a season of stress. Mm-hmm. PTSD is actually a group that we're finding is very susceptible to sensory overload. Yeah, so those would be obviously neurodivergent people. Many neurodivergent people are susceptible to that, not all. And then those who are going through stressful seasons in life, whether you're neurotypical or neurodivergent, those with PTSD, they're finding have are subject to sensory overload as well as the senior population as well.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's amazing. It's a wonder how we even get along in this world, just the way that we all process different things and just the way that we interpret everything. It's a wonder any of us get along.
I totally agree. You're speaking my language.
So yeah, reading your blog, and you were saying about your index card for your goals. And I was like, oh my gosh,
mm-hmm.
I have got to do that. Just kind of like write a goal and also write a process for getting it done. I think that's totally because I've got tons of goal lists, but I need to like write out a process part for it too. Is that something that is specific to neurodivergent people or would that work for anyone?
Do you mean the idea of writing goals down or the executive functioning factor on how am I going to accomplish this goal?
I guess the executive factor, because that's probably what's missing from my goal list.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I don't know why I never thought of it, but I was just like, that is what I need to do.
Yeah. So you're bringing up a really interesting topic. And what I will say is that what I've learned about the executive functioning process in the brain is that those who have difficulty with it,
mm-hmm.
and so those who have difficulty tend to be, of course, very smart people, but the two communicate with each other. They know the what
mm-hmm.
and the how, but they don't know the where and the when.
Yeah.
So those two parts of their brain fail to communicate. And so you end up in this holding pattern because mm-hmm. you get these ideas, you know exactly what to look like, but then the when and the where tends to not happen.
Yeah.
And so that's a trait. I mean, I don't want to say which neurodivergence that falls into because there's so much overlap.
Right.
And I'm getting to the point where I'm learning so much about the different neurodivergence. The overlap is tremendous. So to me, I just say neurodivergent
right.
because I mean, I experience traits of obsessive compulsive disorder, but that's not the forefront of my diagnosis. I'm primarily autistic brain.
Right.
So, you know, we usually kind of lead with our, you know, our leading traits, I guess,
mm-hmm.
but executive functioning is a really big one. It's more so connected with the ADHD brains. Mm-hmm. I followed a scientist who said it really should just be called executive functioning disorder instead of ADHD, but I see where it's coming from, but
yeah,
that kind of puts it too much into one little tiny box.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's something that I have trouble with. I have trouble with focus and follow through for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
a lot of people do experience that.
Mm-hmm. And I don't
or else, the advice I would give to people who are experiencing a lot of that or more than they would like.
Yeah.
Is to find some ADHD influencers to follow on social media. Okay. They're great at giving like micro learning advice mm-hmm. about like, here's a hack for if you can't get something done or whatever.
Right.
Really, really good. People who live with these traits and give really good advice. So that's usually what I recommend.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I love your website. I think I love the information. I think this is everything you have is so valuable, and I think people need to know it.
Yeah, I've certainly have learned my brain just by exploring my art genre, and so someone asked me the other day, "How are you an autism advocate? Do you like go to meetings with people and like speak right. for them or whatever?" I said, "The way I am an autism advocate is that I am openly autistic." I give people a perspective of, okay, maybe autism isn't exactly what I thought it was. Uh-huh. And maybe it's also this and also this. And what I hope it does someday is it creates a world where people who are autistic but feel like they can't disclose it mm-hmm. feel safer to disclose it. And that's what all autism advocates who are open about their diagnosis. It's a common mission that, you know, we're just going to be openly autistic when we can for those who can't yet.
Right. Right. Where would they not be able to be?
In jobs. A lot of employers have a lot of unintentional discrimination against people who are autistic or any type of neurodivergence. They feel like, you know, the job is going to be something that this person can't do because they have a certain type of, they have a, I hate to call it a disability. In some ways it does disable me at times. Mm-hmm. It disables me to be like most people. So mm-hmm. if you say that you can't act like everybody else is the disability, then okay, I guess that's the disability. But a lot of people who want to work, who are neurodivergent, they really need accommodations at work. They need, you know, and everybody can, if you ask them, they can say what accommodations they need. It can be something simple as, I need to know what my work tasks are going to be 3 days mm-hmm. in advance.
Yeah.
I need the instructions to be very clear.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting that I've noticed is that a lot of neurotypical people see that as micromanaging and it's like a faux pas thing to do.
Right.
But neurodivergent brains, we need details. We need to know exactly what you expect. We want how we want it done because we care about that. We just don't think the other way. We don't think like, oh, how could you micromanage me? And like there's some kind of social aspect to it
right.
Where we're offended or whatever. I'm still trying to understand it. But that's an example of an actual accommodation is that if someone discloses to their employer, I'm autistic, I need very clear directions and I need them 3 days in advance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but a lot of people are running into employment challenges simply because of they want to work, but they just are different.
Yeah. 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 I guess I can see how that might be a problem, but I was just curious. But this has been so amazing, and I'm so sorry. My questions were kind of like all over the place, but
No worries. I have a lot of different things to talk about, so you're fine. You hit them all, I think.
At some point. But I really enjoyed this, and I think what you're doing is great work, and you definitely needs to get your message out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this time. It's so nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you too. And where can people find you?
SensoryGatedArt.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. But if you just go to SensoryGatedArt.com, that's where you can find me.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. And this will probably post in a week or two, and I will let you know when it posts, and I'll send you a link.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much to Amanda Hebert Hughes for chatting with me and sharing her new genre. She's doing important work and making great art while doing it. If you want to see more of Amanda and learn about neurodivergent art, she's at sensorygatedart.com. It'll be linked on the post. Thanks for listening. This is a Hotspur Media production. Music by Corey Knoxville.